With that, we'll start with the first case. Love's Travel Stops is the plaintiff appellee versus City of Wall et al. Defendants appellants. Ronald Parsons will be arguing on behalf of the appellants. Kent Hagg and Stephanie Trask are also present this morning for appellants. And then we have Michael Nadolski, who is arguing on behalf of appellee Love's. And Jeff Collins is also present on behalf of Lubs. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Parsons, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time, Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. These days, there are a lot of these giant all-purpose truck stops that are popping up around the country, and the greatest of these is Love's. You can see one on I-90 outside of Kimball. Even in the middle of the night, it lights up the sky, and you can get about everything you need there. Gas, shower, shave, groceries, gadgets, and other goods. There's restaurants and rest areas. And on any given night, you can see or hear dozens of idling 18-wheelers parked across the concrete plaza. Now, Love's wanted to build one of these large and profitable complexes within the city limits of Wall, South Dakota, which happened to be in the quiet part of town next to its prime residential and family neighborhoods. The Wall City Council denied their permit application, and this displeased the Love's Corporation. But this appeal is not, strictly speaking, about whether there ought to be a truck stop in that part of Wall, or even about whether there's a truck stop within the city limits should be decided by the elected city council or by a judge. This appeal is about whether, in considering or acting upon Love's permit application, the Wall City Council disobeyed the specific terms of a mandamus order issued by the Pennington County Circuit Court in August of 2021. The city did not disobey that mandamus order. The city followed that order. It did what it was ordered to do. As a matter of law, it did not commit civil contempt, and so we very respectfully suggest that this case should be reversed. If you trace the evolution of the judicial power of contempt, a critical, very important power, it's how we enforce the rule of law in the United States. But if you trace it from the English crown from 1,000 years ago to the American founding, to U.S. Supreme Court decisions, to the Dakota Territorial Court, and all the way to this court's decision issued just one week ago in Brockley versus Ellis, there really are three universal principles, I would suggest. The first is that civil contempt is not just an extension or a continuation of the underlying action. It's not just another motion you might file in a case, even though it's filed under the same civil number. As this court held in the Simmons case and Otten case and all the way back to State versus Mitchell in 1892, a contempt proceeding is sui generis, meaning it's an action in and of itself, of its own kind. It results in it's a separate action, and it results in a separate judgment, as it did here. Second, I would say, as this court said in its Brockley decision just last week, civil contempt is meant to force a party to comply with an order. That's its purpose. That's its sole purpose. This court said in State versus Knight in 1893, if the contempt consists in the refusal of a party to do something which he's ordered to do for the benefit or advantage of the opposite party, the process is civil, and he stands committed to do that until he complies with the order. And third, as this court has held throughout its history, to form the basis of a subsequent contempt proceeding, the order has to state the details of compliance in such clear, specific, and unambiguous terms that the person to whom it is directed, in this case the City of Wall, will know exactly what duties or obligations are imposed upon it. So it's It's a bedrock principle that in the absence of such clear expression as this court held in Alto Township, which is its most cited case involving the civil contempt power, the trial court's order cannot serve as the basis for a finding of contempt. So, on behalf of the Wall City Council, I would suggest that fundamentally this is a simple case. In the mandamus order, the circuit court held it had no authority to dictate the outcome of the city's conflict of interest analysis under SDCL 6117 that the legislature has enacted to govern these situations. And it said it had no authority, held it had no authority to require the city to issue the permit. Instead, the court, in a thoughtful decision, ordered the city to consider and apply SDCL 6117 and then hold another vote on the permit. As ordered, exactly as ordered, the city considered and applied SDCL 6117 with the assistance of its city attorney, of its own private counsel, and of Doug Abraham, who represents the South Dakota Public Assurance Alliance. They studied the law, they studied the statute, they advised their client, and it was determined following that statute that there was no conflict of interest that required disqualification of any of the city council members.
Well, so, Mr. Parsons, I want to ask you about that. No conflict of interest. Did they decide there was no conflict of interest, or did they only decide whether there was no direct pecuniary interest?
Yep. There's not a direct transcript or record that was tells that precisely, but they followed the statute and concluded that the statute did not require any disqualifications.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that is there's some minutes that seem to reflect that the advice from counsel was you just have to decide whether there's a direct pecuniary interest under 6117. But 6117 is broader than that. Would you agree?
I would, yes. 6117 flatly prohibits direct pecuniary interests, which there was no direct pecuniary interest in this case. After that, then, it says that it's up to the individual member of the council or the governing body to self-assess, determine whether or not they should recuse themselves. And then the safeguard in that statute, as it was described by Senator Schoenbeck when he was testifying on behalf of it, is that any other conflict will be identified by the board itself, and if there's a two-thirds vote, then there will be a recusal.
So if the city council looked at it and, again, looked at their own self-assessment as a body, and then ultimately, is there a direct pecuniary interest, and set that third one aside for a moment.
Yeah.
If the only thing that each council person was considering was whether they had a direct pecuniary interest, was that a failure to comply with the court's order, given that 6117 is broader?
I would suggest that that's not what happened, Your Honor. The statute was gone through in detail by council with the members of the board. But if they applied the statute incorrectly on the advice of counsel, I would say that would never qualify as contempt. That's not a willful and contumacious.
Nobody's briefed this, but is advice of counsel a defense to a contempt action?
It's not advice of, it's not an absolute defense, of course, but certainly it plays into whether there's a willful and contumacious, a willfully disobedient violation.
But then that requires us to get into facts and give deference to the trial court, correct?
I guess it would if there were findings on that. Of course, there were no findings on that, and that's not the issue. And I would respectfully suggest that that's not what happened, Your Honor, because the statute was gone through very carefully, and the record will reflect this, in an executive session with three different attorneys there. It's not there. I know there was some testimony that one of the council members said, I didn't think I had a direct pecuniary interest, but that said nothing about the advice that was given and the detailed analysis that was done by these attorneys. And ultimately, when you apply the statute requires you to assess whether there is a conflict of interest. And then if there is, in the conclusion of two-thirds of the board, then that's when you recuse yourself. Otherwise, it is up to the council. That's what the legislature put in place. It's not a situation that we had in the city of Hanig. City of Hanig, of course, involved indirect pecuniary interests. It's that this person or this entity or whatever this issue might end up competing somehow against me, and so I might get fewer tips in a restaurant if there's a competing steakhouse, or I might sell fewer ice cream cones if there's a competing ice cream seller or gasoline. That's an indirect pecuniary interest. The court here held you should have considered City of Hanig, and essentially the opinion said, well, yes, I know the court told you to apply the statute, but and I know you read the cases, and there's testimony that you were advised about Holborn and the other cases, but you should have read in Holborn that there was this case called City of Hanig versus Winner, and that's the standard you should have really applied. You should have known that. That was, and so therefore it's contempt. But SDCL 6117, which is what the city council was instructed to apply in the order, ironically, was enacted as a direct repudiation of Hanig versus City of Winner. That's the testimony. Senator Schoenbach happens to be here today. And if you read his introduction to the bill, it was widely acknowledged that when City of Hanig came down, 25 years ago, it was an unworkable standard in rural South Dakota, particularly with towns of, 500 people, that indirect pecuniary interests just wouldn't work as the standard. No one would even serve or be eligible on these boards. And so it was enacted without a single dissenting vote by both houses of the legislature to repudiate the standard that the court held the Wall City Council was in contempt for not applying. And I just say that's an error of law.
The court ordered the city to comply with 6117.
Correct.
The first part is the self-identification part, but the second part of 117 is contemplates the city council holding a vote where there's identified potential conflicts of interest. And Love clearly identified the two commissioners or two council members that they thought had some sort of conflict of interest, but the council didn't hold a vote on it, correct?
No, they did, Your Honor. There was a motion that addressed that, and it was unanimously that they held that no one had a conflict of interest. That was part of the procedure. They actually held a vote.
So which hearing did they hold the vote on? Because the meeting, the minutes of the meeting on the 2nd, I think it's September 2nd, indicate that no motion was made to hold that, and so they held no vote on it.
My recollection of the record, Your Honor, is that there was a motion made that we find that there are no disqualifying conflicts, and that was voted on, and that motion passed, that there were no conflicts.
Mr. Parsons, if I might. Of course, the civil power of contempt can be used to enforce by any order of a court, and as you say, this is coercive, not punitive. The idea is to obtain compliance. Is it notable that this order, realizing it could be any order that's valid, this order was a particular kind of order. It was a mandamus order. And those orders really can only be issued in very limited circumstances. Is that at least notable in this case in terms of assessing the clarity of this order and the obligation under it?
It's incredibly important, Your Honor, I think. The court itself said, under this power, I have no authority to dictate the outcome of this analysis, and no authority was its holding to order the issuance of the building permit. It granted the limited relief that it could, and it said you must apply the statute, consider it again, and hold another vote. That was the order. That was the entire substance of the order, and that was done to the letter.
Counsel, So this was kind of a unique underlying proceeding, and it had a mix of interesting and somewhat conflicting requests for remedy. Does the declaratory order that the court, or relief, I should say, that the court issued in conjunction with this mandamus order have any impact on how the mandamus order is carried out, in particular that they should not be considered the zoning ordinance at all? How does that connect here?
Certainly, I think that's part of the order and has effect. the zoning ordinance could not be used, was not to apply to this subject property because of this loophole that existed, because the property was annexed from the city or from the county. It was zoned agricultural, and it had not yet been placed into one of the zones in the district or in the city's municipal zoning code. So if the city had said, this is zoned commercial, and we don't care what the court said, we're saying this is zoned commercial or zoned residential, and we're applying the zoning ordinance, yeah, there, I think that's a different story, but that's not what happened. And it was, the record is clear and undisputed that the city was advised and understood that the zoning ordinance did not apply, that this was not zoned.
Council, can you address some of the contentions that concern the court about the city allegedly slow-walking the application and other procedural irregularities?
Yes. First of all, I don't think those will qualify as contempt because they're not violations of the order. But clients don't vouch for their, or lawyers don't vouch for their clients, but I see nothing objectively that's in bad faith about the court taking the full, I mean, the city council taking the full 30 days to decide whether or not to appeal this order. They disagreed with that zoning part of it because under their ordinances, you have to be in a zone before you can start doing construction. That hadn't happened yet, but that was the city's interpretation, is that you can only build things consistent with the zone you are in. And it wasn't in a zone, so our position was this wasn't an anything-goes situation. It had to be zoned first. But we disagreed. That's not what the court held. We disagreed with that, but we elected not to appeal because we understood exactly what we'd been ordered to do, and we were going to do that in good faith. But I don't think it was slow walked. We waited 30 days. It was a hard decision whether or not to appeal. We didn't appeal. Loves did not appeal from that order. So it was a final order. And then at the next city council meeting, we did the conflict of interest analysis, including the votes. And then at the meeting after that, there was another vote on the permit. So I don't think it was slow walked at all. Those I see as extraneous to the decision because there's nothing in there that really could be even characterized as a violation of what the court ordered. We did what we did, and we did it very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nadolski, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. While much has been made about Loves in this case, I think little has been said about One Shot, which is a small South Dakota company owned by Eric and Natalie Hansen, themselves longtime residents and constituents of Wall. Appellees would agree with the city that the background of this case very much involves representative municipal government. But unlike Loves, unlike One Shot, unlike the Hansons, the city is a political subdivision of the state of South Dakota. And as observed by the circuit court, it has only such powers as are delegated by the state or are as reasonably or necessarily implied from those powers. And as Mr. Parsons has focused on the court's memorandum opinion and order of August 12th of 2021, I want to talk about three parts of that because I think it's important for this court to understand what the court had ordered, the circuit court had ordered, and the facts that the circuit court saw within the entirety of the record.
Before you do that, Mr. Nadolski, let me ask you, Loves brought this as a contempt application. Could they have brought a petition for certiorari or a petition for mandamus after the reconsideration?
They could have. They already had. And I think that the problem with that is you get into this endless cycle whereby you don't think that the municipality is following its own rules and regulations. It had already brought a writ for certiorari and a writ for mandamus and a declaratory action. And this litigation had been going on for some time.
But doesn't that speak to the nature of what your remedy is in contempt, too? If you're basically saying we could could never get to where we needed to get on a petition for certiorari. Doesn't that ultimately answer the question of the contempt remedy?
I think from the appellee's perspective, the court had ordered the municipality to consider its building permit in light of its declaration, follow its rules, and it didn't do so. And I would submit that that's the exact reason that one brings a contempt action, is because the order wasn't followed.
So is that a proxy motion, an end run around? That's what the city's argued.
I understand that. I would respectfully disagree with that viewpoint because, again, I would go back to the part of the order, and there were two parts to that. One was that the court had declared that the zoning ordinance, Title 17, did not apply to the subject property, and I'd like to talk a little bit about why that's significant in order to answer that question. First of all, Title 17, the zoning ordinance, stems from the municipality's state delegated police powers over land use. And the court had ruled, in a ruling that was not appealed by the city, that those regulations, the entirety of that regulation, was not to be applied to the subject property. And as Mr. Parsons pointed out earlier, the argument was that if, in order for the appellees or Loves to undertake the proposed land use, it had to be placed within one of its districts. And it's also important to note that under that zoning ordinance, if it were to be placed in that district, then the proposed use would be subject to a compatibility determination by the governing body. But the court had ruled that those rules don't apply. In addition to that, in ordering the writ, the court reviewed the other title, Title 15, and that pertains to building codes and standards. Those powers are derived from a totally different chapter. That's Chapter 1110, not Chapter 114. And the city had passed an ordinance regarding building codes and standards. And the court, obviously, in reaching its mandamus decision, had obviously reviewed both ordinances and had ordered the city to entertain the building permit application pursuant to those regulations. So coming away from that, appellees anticipated that the city would follow through with that and entertain their building permit application in accordance with the rules that they had adopted.
But that seems to sort of circle back to the Chief Justice's question. That seems more like certiorari review, right? Did the local board act within its jurisdiction? Did it regularly pursue its authority? A more qualitative review. Contempt is a laser beam. Did you comply? Did you execute the order? Seemingly good, bad, or indifferent, or so the appellants would hold. And that, I think, is an important distinction, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on whether that's significant here.
I can't deny that it's a significant inquiry, but I would say that, again, from Appley's viewpoint, the order was clear as to what was to transpire, and based on what it had observed and based on what was put in the record, the city clearly did not comply with what the judge had ordered.
Well, a contempt finding requires more than a finding that the city didn't comply with the order. The court has to find that they willfully and contumaciously didn't comply with the order. And that's the real issue here. What makes it willful and contumacious?
I believe it was willful in two regards. Part of what was discussed earlier, and if you go back to Appley's pleadings, no one had ever accused or was concerned that any of the council members had direct pecuniary interests. No one ever claimed that any of the council members had a direct stake in the project. The concern was with indirect pecuniary interests. And I think what was before the court and in the record was that The city was advised that a direct pecuniary interest would need to be identified in order for there to be a disqualification. And appellees nor the court thought that that was in compliance with 6117. How did the court know that? Well, again, it was in the minutes, and also it derived that from some testimony. The second part of the willful part is that the city had adamantly denied that it wasn't utilizing its zoning criteria. And by that, I mean its evaluation of the land use, not the building or the standards, but how the use was going to be utilized. And that was clearly something that the court said did not apply to its considerations. But while the city claimed that they didn't do that, I don't think that the court was persuaded by what they said they did. The court was persuaded by what they actually did and found a willful course of conduct within the facts in front of the circuit court.
City Council is required to review and determine whether any member of the City Council was disqualified as provided under STCL 6117. How did they not do that?
For this reason, and it's because the focus was always on direct pecuniary interests. And if you read, and as the court had alluded to at the very beginning of it, the legislature hasn't said only direct pecuniary interests. It says any conflict of interest. And Holborn, I think, doesn't foreclose the possibility that conflicts of interest other than direct pecuniary interest may disqualify an official from voting or discussing on an issue.
Is that Holborn sourcing that rule to 6117, or is that Holborn sourcing that rule to something else? Because the court didn't say, take your vote and determine disqualifications under Holborn or 6117 and Holborn. It said 6117.
I think Holborn stands for the proposition, or it's instructive to those officials, that those determinations are to be left to the subjective determinations of the City Council.
So then how do you get to contempt if it's a subjective determination? How do you ultimately make a determination that they willfully failed to comply and obey the court's order?
Because based on what was in the record, the minutes, the instructions that they received, in addition to the testimony of at least two of the City Council members, the court was not convinced that they looked at anything other than direct pecuniary interests.
Yeah. Which seemingly aligns with what the statute is, though.
And I would respectfully disagree with that, because I think in order to align with the statute, there has to be an inquiry of whether there are any other conflicts of interest. The very heading of the statute speaks to whether any conflict of interest exists. And then the statute further breaks down what is mandatory and what is left to the subjective determinations of the officials. And the court was not convinced that the city followed her order to conduct an evaluation based on that statute, which, again, I think is broader than just direct pecuniary interests.
I hate to jump around too much, but I want to talk to you a little bit about the inquiry that the court undertook to determine a remedy for contempt. And I know some of our cases use that phrase, and they use it in a way that I'm not always sure it's remedial, but this is the contempt power of the court, which should, in this instance, using this authority, be coercive and applied in a way to obtain compliance with the order. Here, it looks like I don't see anything about compliance. I see only that the court decided to do what the court did and issue the building permit. What kind of a remedy was the court looking for? Because am I wrong in thinking that the consequence of a contempt finding where it exists is to then act to obtain compliance? How did this act or the order, the court's ultimate order issuing the building permit coerce in an effort to obtain compliance?
I think that the circuit court had determined that there was no discretion left to be made. In light of its ruling on Title 17 and in light of its review of Title 15, that the building application had fully complied with all the requirements of the city. And having made that determination, determined that but for the city's contempt, the court fashioned a remedy that put the appellees back in the place of it would have been but for this contempt.
That sounds more like summary judgment than coercion to obtain compliance. That just sounds like I'm judge is making a finding as a matter of law. Everything seems to be in order. I'm going to make a finding as a matter of law and grant relief as a matter of law. This is civil contempt. It has to be coercive in an effort to obtain compliance.
And I think the compliance part, and again, is the issuance of the building permit.
And that's a discretionary act, you would agree, the issuance of a building permit?
I think it's a discretionary act to a certain point. I think that discretion can be abused, and that's what the court ultimately, in its opinion, focused on.
But irrespective of, let's take it out of the contempt arena for just a moment. We've got a court telling the city council, you have to grant this building permit. I'm granting it for you. Isn't the court really putting on the city council's hat by doing that and stepping beyond the authority that the court said the first time around, I don't have the authority to do that? How does that not invade the ultimate authority the city council has and the court doesn't have under statutes and the Constitution?
From the viewpoint of the circuit court at the time that the court made that initial decision, going forward, it had become abundantly apparent that things and facts that had existed in the beginning were no longer the case.
Yeah, and I don't want to ask you about the viewpoint of the court. I want to ask you about what legal authority supported the court's ability to say, I'm granting the building permit.
For remedies for contempt, the court is given broad discretion in fashioning a remedy. And that is in view of not only the law, but the circumstances of the contempt.
If the order was consider this permit without considering the zoning ordinance, as I declared that you must not, wouldn't the remedy then to ensure compliance have been go back again and consider it without considering the land use issues that are encompassed in the zoning ordinance?
Justice, I think that could have been a possibility, but that's not what the circuit court chose to do here.
And in that way, the city would have had an opportunity to purge the contempt by complying with the order. A hallmark of civil contempt.
It would have, but it was apparent to the court that it was not following its orders. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Podolsky. Mr. Parsons, you can proceed with your rebuttal.
I'm going to just jump in with a quick question because your time is limited here. So you've indicated you don't think there was a question of fact as to whether the county instead applied the zoning ordinance against the court's declaration when it made its determination. And I see that they said they did not, and they refer to the health, safety, or well-being of the citizens. But can you explain to me how that is connected to the provisions of the building code and what they were to consider under the court's ruling, right or wrong, in granting the permit? How does that not refer to land use type issues as your opposing counsel has argued?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the case law is clear that when a governing body is considering a permit, they're entitled to consider how that permit will affect the community, the health, safety, and welfare of the community. That is not only a zoning issue. And when you're talking about contempt, the court said, now consider whether you will grant this permit again after you do a conflict of interest analysis. The court, in its contempt order, never said what part of the order was violated by the city. I mean, one has to be able to say you violated this part of the contempt order. They did not apply the zoning ordinance. There's no evidence that they applied the zoning ordinance. There's the suggestion in the briefs that maybe they applied zoning considerations. That's kind of the vague assertion. But one can consider when granting a permit, it's not a rubber stamp. It's not, you get a permit if you apply for one. Boom.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think this is kind of unique in that it wasn't an order that what you must consider. It was solely limited to what you cannot.
That's right.
And that's what I was getting at, is what if, is there anything in the record factually before the court that they did not comply with?
There's nothing, Your Honor. In fact, I think the court's order said there's no way to know. It was, and that's not contempt. We're far beyond contempt. In a contempt order, the court orders you to tear down a wall. The person says, I'm not going to tear down the wall. I don't care what the court said. So the court says, I'm charging you $500 a day until that wall comes down. That's contempt. Here, no one can point to what part of the order was violated. You didn't do this. What didn't you do? Well, we applied the statute and we held another vote, and that's what the order said to do. And so we did that in good faith. And I just don't see, we're so far beyond. And when you have to go to, well, you, supposition upon supposition and inference upon inference, you should have known this and that should have caused you to think about this. We're way beyond contempt. This was a final mandamus order that was never appealed. A notice of entry was issued 2 years ago. And, you know, although this building application, in our view, is a dead letter, if this court reverses, they can bring another building application. I mean, nothing is set in stone. Minds change, plans change, councils change. But this permit application was denied, and that was a discretionary act by the city council that took in all the information and represented its constituents. And there's no allegation of bad faith here. We consider contempt to have just been an end around, an attempt to have the court relitigate the question. And really, that's what happened. The court not only relitigated the question, it absolutely reversed its entire decision. The court cannot grant this relief, but now the court is ordering this relief. And relitigation of underlying order is prohibited under every court that's ever looked at the judicial power of contempt, of civil contempt. It's purely for enforcing the order. So if the order was violated, and I can't point to any section where they didn't do what they were told to do or did what they were told not to do, if it was violated, the remedy would be, okay, do what the original order said to do. And what did the original order say to do? Apply the statute and hold another vote. So we respectfully suggest that this should be reversed and that this proceeding should be dismissed with prejudice, this contempt action, which is its own creature under South Dakota law. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.